This is Fight Back with Bob Petrakis and Connie Goodell Newton on WCRS 98.3 102.1.
Chase! Deutschbank!
Studio. We're welcoming Seth Tabachman, and he's presenting his book, Understanding the Crash.
Well, what do we need to know to understand the crash, Seth?
What do we need to know? I think the most important thing to know is that it's been the policy of conservative politicians, conservative political organization in this country all the way from the 1980s to degrade the American economy in the interest of the multinational corporations. The right in America presents itself as very nationalist, as, you know, that they're the flag wavers, they're the real patriots. But starting with the Reagan administration, and pretty much consistently through all governments to this point, we've seen we've seen first free trade, which resulted in loss of jobs here in the United States, and then deregulation of many industries, and particularly most recently the banking industry, which then allowed the development of this, you know, colossal credit fiasco of the last 10 years, and has brought us to this point. So that there's a whole series of policy decisions all the way down the line which lands us where we are today.
So by degrading, you really start with deregulation, and you allow this massive concentration of banking interests that are too big to fail. And then when they do fail, which in part is on purpose, we bail them out?
Well, the government has bailed out the financial institutions and not bailed out the population, because it, apparently that was the part of the economy that was relevant to the people in government.
Let's take a little look at your background. How did you get started? We're looking at Understanding the Crash. Is this your latest book?
This is my latest book, and I should point out, seeing as people can't see it on the radio, it's a comic book.
Okay, why a comic book?
I started out doing comics because that was what I liked to do. So I'm not going to say that, oh, comic books are a better medium for this or that. This is what I naturally do. I draw and I write and I put words and pictures together. And in, you know, like a lot of people when I was a kid, I read, you know, the comic books with the guys with the capes and the tights and, you know, beat up the bad guys, which seemed very relevant to me because I got into a fist fight once a week and so did the Hulk, but he won. So I liked him better than me. But as I got older, that material wasn't relevant to me, and I didn't want to pretend it was, so I started trying to develop other material. And in 1979, my friend Peter Cooper and I started a magazine called World War III Illustrated, which was a political comic book that was that we produced out of the Lower East Side of New York. And it dealt with a wide range of issues. It dealt first with international issues, with the rise of Reagan, but then also a lot with housing issues and with economic issues. And a lot of different comic book artists have come through that collective who started out with us and may have become more well-known later, such as Eric Drucker or James Romberger or Sabrina Jones, all started in World War III Illustrated. So I've been, you know, working along these lines of trying to do comic strips that convey what's happening in society for over 20 years now. And some of my books include one which I understand I can't say the name of. It's You Don't Have to F Something People Over to Survive.
Okay, and we'll allow the listeners to fill in whatever that F means.
Right.
Well, I think the medium of using comic books, especially to talk about political ideas, to convey political messages, it's really great because it makes subject matters accessible to a lot of audiences that maybe otherwise you know, wouldn't be reading financial magazines about the crash or something like that. They wouldn't be reading, like, financial literature that gets put out in the field for bankers and financial advisors and things like that, or public interest lawyers or, you know, whatever. And the illustrations in your book really just send the message home. And even if you do have a background, you know, in some kind of, like, finance or, you know, with mortgages and stuff like that, it really, I think, humanizes the topic and also makes it accessible to people maybe who are experiencing some of those problems.
Well, to put together the book, we and I had several collaborators I worked with on the book, Eric Larson and Jessica Worrell. We had to read through the books that were being churned out about the economic crash. And as a writer, I think most of what I read was just, from a literary point of view, really awful, because they use an enormous amount of unnecessary jargon to sort of, you know, create a firewall between the information and the people who really need to know it. They use language in a very manipulative way. Like, for instance, the term leverage. Leverage just means debt. So if you say, well, our company would like to do business to you, we're leveraged at the moment, that means they owe a lot of money. Mm-hmm. That doesn't sound good, but leverage makes it sound good, you know, right? Like, who wouldn't want some leverage?
A leveraged buyout, right, which means we're going to take on a huge amount of debt
to buy something.
And often the LBOs would be the assets of a company that wasn't in debt. Someone's coming in from the outside and essentially taking debt against the assets
right
that they're about to buy up. P- putting people in debt, laying people off when it was a healthy company.
Right. And so, you know, I feel that stripping away a lot of that unnecessary verbiage actually really helps the content.
Yeah.
That to use simple images and simple, straightforward explanations of things, I think actually makes it clearer than the way it's normally written. Also, most of the books written about the economy tend to be written with an imaginary reader in mind who is, say a doctor who wants to know where to invest his savings.
Right.
You know, and we wanted to do a book for everybody that really addressed the issue from how it affects everyone in society, but particularly the low-income people in the society. We all thought this was a really interesting phenomenon and a really important phenomenon because you rarely have something in American society that actually affects everyone. And what you see in the mortgage crisis of 2 years ago, which continues till this date, is something that affects very poor people. It affects middle-class people. It affects wealthy people, all in different ways. But, I mean, you can find boarded-up mansions in Coral Gables, Florida, you know. So this is something that everybody got caught up in. So we wanted a book that everyone could read, and a book that you could read in one night and understand what we were saying. And I think we got that. I think it's pretty clear, and I think it shows who's responsible and where the problem is and what people can do about it to some extent.
And we're broadcasting from the carriage house of a boarded-up mansion for 4 years. Unfortunately, not in Coral Gables, Florida. Did your background come out of the... I wish it was in Coral Gables. But did your background really come out of that zine movement at all? Punk movement in the late 70s, early 80s? Were you connected at all with that?
Well, yeah. I mean, I actually grew up in Cleveland, and as a comic book fan in Cleveland, I knew a guy named Harvey Pekar. He was a neighbor, and, you know, we used to go over to his house, and he would show us comic books we weren't legally old enough to read, and my mother was very suspicious of him. And he eventually would write and self-publish these comics about working-class life in Cleveland. And we were also publishing comic book fanzines. And then when I went to New York, Peter Cooper and I moved to New York when we got around 20, we started self-publishing a political comic book, and we were definitely connected to punk music and that scene because that was our distribution. At that time, you didn't have... the word graphic novel hadn't been established for the publishing industry. You didn't really have... You had comic shops, but they didn't usually carry more serious material. The comic shops were a little weirded out by us and all the politics in the magazine. And where we got distributed was we got distributed by Mordam Records, which was the distributor for the Dead Kennedys and the various like hardcore groups out of the West Coast. And they picked us up. And so we were probably the only comic book whose primary distribution was in record stores for many years.
All right, and hopefully you're familiar with Steve Bader and the Dead Boys.
Sure.
I want to Cleveland's finest, and
yeah.
Of course the... That
Peter Loeffner.
Yeah.
Yes, Peter Loeffner.
And that whole Akron movie. Okay, there was a real feel back then, a lot of do-it-yourself and people going into the Kinko's of the day and simply... I mean, making copies, perhaps not paying the full market value of what they copy, but that was a massive flourishing movement and very creative at the time.
Yeah, I think it...
Do you want to talk about some of your techniques that you use and for creating the art and self-publishing?
Sure.
It looks like you use stencils.
I've done a lot of work using stencils. We did a lot of spray paint stencils on the street, and then that translated very well to print.
Yeah, but you stayed away from federal buildings, property, which often is a felony.
Well, I would actually say the that's timed out. We did them all over New York.
But I mean,
yeah.
All right.
But, I mean, graffiti was an important movement, influenced our work, and street art and graffiti. And also, the ability to make something print on a sidewalk, or the ability to make something print very cheaply, meant paring down the work to where it's extremely reproducible. And one of the results of that is that a lot of people, particularly in the 80s, would like photocopy our work from the magazine and make it into patches, make it into t-shirts or even tattoos or murals, and I would sort of see the work reappear in many different forms. And so I think it had a reach considerably wider than the print run of the publication.
This is Fight Back with Bob Fitrakis and Connie Goodell Newton on WCRS 98.3, 102.1.
So you're in New York in the late 70s or early 80s by
yeah.
then. Any connections with essentially the burgeoning hip-hop movement over in the Bronx there? You know, one of the first white rappers was really Debbie Harry. I remember, I mean, she didn't do it well, but mm-hmm. there seemed to be a connection to that community, and graffiti really was king and inseparable from the early hip-hop movement.
Well, I think graffiti was very exciting for us because it combined a lot of different things we were interested in. You know, it combined cartooning, but then it decontextualized it and made it something else. Like, all of a sudden, Mickey Mouse sprayed up on a wall was not Mickey Mouse anymore. He was something else. And that really interested me. And we do, there's at least one cartoonist who currently works on the magazine on World War III who was a writer actually at that time, which is Sandy Jimenez. And you can see if you look at his artwork, he has very much that sort of bubbly style of drawing, those round sweeping lines that a lot of graffiti writers have. And he does a series for the magazine, which again has a word I can't say on the radio, the Something House Poet. Yeah, I think that affected us a lot. I think the idea that the barriers around what was art and what was mass media and what was politics had broken down was a good thing for us because it allowed us to experiment a lot more, particularly with what we wanted to do, which was to approach serious subject material in the comic book medium.
Right. So, in your book, Understanding the Crash, we have Seth Tobachman here presenting his book, Understanding the Crash. It looks like you explain a lot about how the mortgage foreclosure crisis happened and how it has impacted a lot of people. But I believe you also talk about things that people can do, such as foreclosure defense and stuff like that, and protesting, mm-hmm. And with the pitchforks, you know. So recently, you were actually in Columbus and bringing art and activism together.
Yeah, I was invited down here by David Solnick, who was working with a group called National People's Action, who were organizing a protest at the national headquarters of Chase Bank, which is here in Columbus and which is reputed to be the largest office building in the world. I don't know if it actually is, but it's reputed to be. And I know they moved, I know they had the annual meeting of Chase Bank in New York a year ago, and they moved it to Columbus because they thought that there were too many protesters against them in New York.
Right?
It would be safer in Columbus.
It would be safer,
right?
But you went to them, right?
Well, a lot of people went to them from all over the country.
Yeah,
and
the word got around.
Yeah, and I had the privilege of working on banners and props and visuals for that protest, which was pretty colorful and pretty interesting and on a pretty big scale. So that was exciting. I think that...
I saw some of the pictures from the protest. Mm-hmm. Would you want to describe some of those?
Yeah, okay. People sunk a giant wooden cutout of the... Well, okay, I first have to describe the area.
Yeah.
The Chase office building actually has a moat around it. I'm not kidding. It's got a moat. It has a moat.
It's medieval, you know? And they torture people.
Right.
Yeah. So they don't want people coming in.
Right.
And
so, like, I think people just couldn't resist the image of the moat.
There's a moat there for
the
a moat. Reason, right?
Yeah.
It's irresistible.
Yeah. And so they had a number of actions that were related to the fact that it was a moat. First of all, because it was very medieval, a lot of people dressed up as Robin Hood. Second, at one point they built a bridge to cross the moat, which they put down in the middle of the moat, and protesters crossed onto the other side. Another was that they built this giant wooden cutout of the Grant Wood painting, American Gothic, except with like the house in the background boarded up, right? And we sunk it into the moat, so they're sinking in water. They're underwater. So there were you know, some way out gestures like that, which I think you know gave it, you know, a little, maybe a little lighter atmosphere or a little more humorous atmosphere, and maybe
I think actions like that also raise awareness and get the point across, and it's good to see that. I think art can really make an impact on people's mind and how they think about an issue and help educate people. So I think that sounds great. And the Robin Hood.
Oh, yeah. Well,
Robin Hood is...
Well, I mean, the photograph of David Solnit getting arrested dressed as Robin Hood is just too good.
Yeah.
It's like any kid knows what the issue was if they see that photo. So I think that was... You know, the Robin Hood costumes were brilliant... idea on David's part, because it's something everyone understands. You don't have to explain Robin Hood to anyone.
Right.
And it seems even with the cover of the book, I mean, arguably, you could argue that that's flag desecration there. I mean, iconic symbols, a flag on a house. Actually, I've seen flags painted on houses, and I've actually seen a flag in brick when I used to live in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
So that whole notion of the flag painted on the house, which, you know, people do on barns, on houses, mm-hmm. and then the boarded up nature makes it, you know, look like somebody's desecrated the flag. And but in this case, the argument, it was the predators, and in many cases represented as sharks in the book. Mm-hmm. And
well, I think, you know, again, to me, the point of, I use the flag a lot in this book, and to me, the point of it, of using the flag, is to point out that as I've said, you know, the right always claims to represent the United States, to be American. They all attack people they don't agree with as anti-American, but actually the right has presided over the dismantling of the American economy, and that's why I use the flag a lot in this particular book.
Well, you know, when they moved to the Cayman Islands with 22,000 other corporations to avoid taxes, or go to communist China, or build jeeps in Hanoi under the communist government they once hated. Doesn't that mean they're going to have to run a few more commercials waving the flag?
I guess so.
And theorists have dealt with this. Gramsci being the most famous, is as he was dying in the prison there in Italy during World War II, but. A lot of it is capture the flag. Who controls the symbols? And I always thought it was odd that these corporations, which arguably are 52 of the largest economies in the world, the other 48 being nation states, that these large entities are able to sell the destruction of the American worker and the American economy as in some ways patriotic. A lot of your book seems to be about taking back the flag for ordinary people, mm-hmm. and pointing out the hypocrisy of the people that are waving it.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, it's important to go to people with symbols that are already meaningful, and realize that, you know, whatever has been done in the name of the symbol still stands for some basic value people have. And so, to me, I thought the flag was important. I use Uncle Sam in the book. I used to do a lot of pieces with the Statue of Liberty. I've always liked the Statue of Liberty. One of the few female symbols in the American set of symbols is the Statue of Liberty. So I try to use that stuff and to try to bring that in, and to look for the real meaning of it as opposed to the meaning it's been given.
So when we look at our, you know, you're tired, you're huddled, and your huddled masses are yearning to be free. It was Lou Reed who once said.
There's going to be a lot more of them with all the homelessness and foreclosure. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
No, yeah. I mean, quite literally.
Basically, we're creating many more huddled masses in the streets of Columbus, because in my neighborhood there are plenty of boarded up and burned out buildings now.
And you're really talking about the dream being foreclosed on, the dream being home ownership, working hard, not in many ways being taken advantage of by what are predators, mm-hmm. and there's numerous predators throughout your book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely use the image of bankers as sharks, which of course is not original to me in any way at all. It's a very old image of the loan shark. I chose to use that because when I started researching the book, one of the first places I went was the East Side Organizing Project in Cleveland, and I interviewed them, and I saw that they were using the shark as their image. In fact, one of their first protests was at an office of Countrywide Bank, and they were throwing plastic sharks at them. And I said, okay, well, so the shark already has currency, and I'll use that as the symbol because people already use it, they already understand it, and so I can speak through that. And it's more fun to draw a shark than a banker, actually. I mean, really, it's kind of unfair to compare sharks and bankers. It's unfair to the shark, because the shark would never do that.
Well,
but it's more fun to draw
them.
Yeah.
On loan sharks, is that the rates they were charging, those predatory rates, were far and away, if you looked at the actual prime rate that the government was charging, that any loan shark back in the 50s would have charged people.
Sure. Absolutely.
So how can our listeners get a copy of your book, or do you have a website
should be available at a lot of progressive bookstores.
Okay.
I'm not sure which bookstores are in the area, but if you can't do that, you can get it from you can get it from Soft Skull Press, who put it out. They have a website, and you can order it through them.
Yep, it looks like softskull.com.
Or you can order it from Amazon, or if you go to my website, sethtobachman.com, there'll be a link where you can go to someplace where you can order it.
And the place where you make the most money and or Amazon doesn't would be your website.
Well, not really, because I'm not set up to do that yet. But
it's
a good idea, but I haven't gotten around to it. So I'm not. I mean, is there a good bookstore in Columbus who you think will probably have it? You might know better than me.
Let's see. Like the Chase Manhattans, most of the independent bookstores were put out of business.
Right.
In the last 20 years, we at the Free Press, which we've been around since 1970, part of us not being in print other than once a year now is that all of those independent coffee shops, all those independent bookshops have been bought up. But there is a nice little place called Urban Spirit, which has a small bookshop, black-owned, that's over on Long Street that we could probably talk into carrying.
Well, we should make, I should give them a call. We should make sure they carry it, I think.
Yeah. But quite literally, those leverage buyouts of the huge bookstores, which... all those independent spaces destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Seth, thank you so much for being our guest. We have Seth Tobachman with Understanding the Crash on tour. And so what's next for you?
Tomorrow night I'm going to be at Visible Voice in Cleveland at 7 o'clock. That is on Wednesday night.
And you then have a slideshow presentation.
Yes, I have a multimedia presentation, which, as you heard, involves some recorded music. On Thursday, I'm going to be at Revolution Books in Cleveland at Cedar and Mayfield. And then on Friday, I'm going to be at a new space on 117th Street in Cleveland, organized by a bunch of people called the Possibilitarian Puppet Theater.
Wow.
All right, and Revolution Books, many of us know, the old RCP, and the organization that gave us Rage Against the Machine, one of the great bands of the 1990s.
Well, we really appreciate you coming to Columbus and sharing your book and presentation with us. You came to the Spore Print Info Shop recently and gave a presentation there. And also, thank you so much for bringing your art and activism to Columbus.
Well, thank you for hosting me.
Thank you for being here.
This is Fight Back with Bob Fitrakis and Connie Goodell Newton on WCRS 98.3, 102.1.